You're listening to episode 12-8, the Tech Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Desert Eagle Allen. With me tonight is the man Eiffel 65 wrote a song about. I'm talking about Eric. I'm Blue Swim.
Your magical kicks are no match for my leaping tiger fist.
And let's not forget the lawman, talking about Jeremy Lamont.
I am here. Fear not.
And not with us tonight is Sage Samarage Morris Green. She claims that law school is kicking her ass, and I believe she's striving to earn a Tony or an Oscar, some such award. She's got a production going on.
Oh, I thought you got the Tony for your like law school antics.
That would be good. I believe that's the Grammy.
Oh, the Grammy. Yes, I think you're right.
The Emmy.
The Razzie.
That's the lowest performing law school candidate. Anyway, we got some impressions to talk about, so I want to travel back in time for a second, all the way back to 2000, probably September, I think. When
the year 2000.
2000.
The year 2000.
This is the musical show. 2001, when Tokitori was released for the Game Boy Color over by Capcom. And later it was released a number of years later for the WiiWare service. And what the game was about, it tasked players with helping this cute little yellow, orangey chicken gather up all his unborn egg-based brethren. It was it's kind of a nifty little puzzler. It reminded me a little bit of Lemmings. It borrowed some of the mechanics there. You created bridges. It was based on platforms there. And what you did was you used items from a very limited toolbox. There were some things like a telewarp, which was like a old school 2D version of the portal gun. As I mentioned, you could lay down bridges. And you had this limited weaponry. And what all these tools combined, what they force you to do is really think about how you complete the level using the tools that were allotted to you. So I went into Tokitori 2 expecting the same type of gameplay, or at least similar. And let's just say that despite very vibrant visual palette, it's been upgraded to 720p, 60 frames per second, a little waver every once in a while. But other than that, the game is completely different. And it is one of the most unique puzzle experiences of the past year or so. I'm not sure I'm really enjoying myself with it, and I'll get to that. It's a very minimal, feels very different than anything else I've played. So let me explain why. Like many gamers, I've come to expect kind of text-based instruction as part of the genre. And with Tokitori, the game is best described, as I said, very minimal, and it encourages experimentation. One of the first things you notice is that except for the title logo and there's some placards kind of telling you what to do, there's really no text, which probably makes localization for the European market super easy. Instead, the game, it prods you along. It does that by removing its predecessor's toolbox. Tokitori, the main character, the chicken, only has two functions. He can whistle and he can stomp, much like you, Mr. Lamont.
I stomp good.
You stomp good? Were you in the Broadway production of Stomp? Were you banging those garbage cans?
Crash and whistle.
Yes. That was your onstage name. So anyway, that with only two things, it may sound limiting, but the developers at Two Tribes, they came up with every conceivable permutation of these actions. So one thing you do is you'll stop. You'll stomp to get a little bug moving, and then you'll move and you'll whistle to get a frog's attention. And once the frog gobbles up the bug, then you stomp him to release a bubble, and then you take that bubble, and that gets you up to the next platform. So stomp and whistle, a lot of stomp and whistle. At first, the game's a very linear side-scroller. But then, and I don't want to ruin this, so I'm going to be strategically ambiguous. You uncover a few things that you realize the game just opens wide open, and you begin whistling Morse code for a feather taxi ride. But I'm not really enjoying it as much as I should, and I think part of the problem is I'm looking at it from an objective. It's a good game, maybe not a game that I really want to play as much as I think others. Part of that is kind of the laid-back vibe that it has. The other is the game, and this is probably a little bit more objective, it offers very few clues to what you should be doing or going next. And And I think a little bit of the problem stems from puzzle design, because every once in a while I didn't really use my brain, but I discovered something just by simply whistling and stomping away there. So that's a little Tokitori 2. I haven't finished it yet, but put about 5 hours or so into that one. Just got in today, Injustice, Gods Among Us. No applause, no boos.
I'm not sure. Reactions. You know, here's the thing. I mean, I liked Mortal Kombat. This is from NetherRealm, right?
Yes.
This is
same
thing
studio. Yes.
Yep. And so I liked the most recent Mortal Kombat, and mm-hmm. I think they also did the Mortal Kombat versus DC, right?
Yes.
Kind of not good. So I guess I was just waiting with bated breath to hear what you thought. I could see it going either way.
This is a redemption for the DC versus MK. I tooled around with the single-player campaign. I played about a dozen matches, so really early impressions. This isn't going to cover everything. First, the physics. No surprise here. Feels very Mortal Kombat. And by that, I mean, what was it? MK9, I guess, is the... no one actually calls it that, but referred to it as
I kind of wondered about that. Is it really actually Mortal Kombat 9, or is it the 9th Mortal Kombat?
It is the 9th Mortal Kombat, but just to differentiate it from the original MK1.
Like Tomb Raider.
Right, exactly.
Tomb Raider 7.
That's the new trend.
Yeah, kind of.
Including causing some confusion there. I'm sure GameStop in their SKUs have a difficult
Twisted
time.
Twisted Metal.
That's right. Guy, are you going to name them all, Jeremy?
I could maybe just randomly name some and probably not be too far off, right?
No. So anyway, The combat strikes really feel punishing. The way characters kind of, they react, they kind of bounce when hit. The pacing, the combos. I mean, it's got Ed Boon's fingerprints all over the physics. But the one thing that's smart is this isn't just a reskinned Mortal Kombat. For one thing, there's the button system. Characters have three basic attacks and then a special button. I believe it's called the power button. And for every character, it's different. For Superman, for instance, you get more strength. Superman becomes stronger. I don't even know how that's possible. Batman throws batarangs. And the other thing that's really interesting is the clash system. And this is where both players, they wager their super meter juice, I guess, if you will. And if the player who, get this, initiates the clash, if they bet more, then they get health back in proportion to the wager. Otherwise, you take damage. And so there's kind of, a poker dynamic to it. The arenas were filled with all kinds of interactive things. There were like missiles and tablets to be used. And what is interesting so far, I've discovered that it's character-dependent. And Superman was this big old ham fist. He just happened to break everything that he touched, which is probably realistic. So that's all I can say. I played about 12 matches. The online matchmaking was pretty quick. I didn't see any slowdown. The character, one thing that I did notice that was kind of jarring was the cutscenes and the in-game graphics. There was a kind of a wide disparity in the look and the aesthetics there.
So does it do the like weaving in and out story kind of thing like MK9?
Yes, it does. MK
nice.
Mortal Kombat.
MK Mortal Kombat.
One question. Thing I wondered. Yes, Blue. I'm Blue.
Long tights Wonder Woman or short tights Wonder Woman?
I know that there's a whole shitload of costumes. I don't think I played Wonder Woman. I was mainly playing, Batman, Superman. I don't even think I came across her. So I'll have to get back to you on Wonder Woman. I know that's a burning question for you. Harley Quinn, she was looking sexy. Did play against her. So.
Right. Yeah, but was she competent, though? Like, was she a strong woman?
Yeah, she was fast, yeah. I think she kicked my butt.
Okay. So. Just making sure.
Does she still have the Batman animated series voice actress, or is it somebody new?
I couldn't tell, honestly. I haven't watched the animated series. I know the voice.
Mr. J!
Yeah, it sounded like, Harley Quinn supposed to, but the lip syncing wasn't really up to par at the end of round. But I don't know. So some good, competent fighting game seemed really cool and a good direction for it. Fun to play. I think Blue. I think you'd like it.
Does it feel so? I guess here you mentioned that this is kind of a redemption for the Mortal Kombat versus DC, and I know you probably didn't mean that as a direct comparison.
The DC characters, because I wasn't a huge fan of.
So that's kind of just really quickly, and I know you haven't played much, but I'm kind of wondering what this feels like it's doing right that Mortal Kombat versus DC did wrong.
The DC characters felt really shoehorned into the Mortal Kombat universe, and some things felt a little clunky, and This feels different because of, you know, the attack system, and it has different mechanics there, and just feels better. I think before we hit Mortal Kombat 9, there was that transition period in Mortal Kombat, and that DC game was part of that. Yeah. I think DC 9 really, or I'm sorry, MK9 really kind of polished that.
Of course, DC versus Mortal Kombat or whatever, that was also a 3D fighter as opposed to strictly 2D.
Yeah, one of the things is Mortal Kombat in 3D, it just always felt a little clunky to me.
Yeah.
I liked it, but it just felt a little clunky. And one thing about Mortal Kombat is I tend to favor, I guess, the Japanese fighters, because Mortal Kombat, I think it's more of the kind of start and stop. It feels herky-jerky to me a little bit more. I don't know, maybe it's the way I play and things like that. There's not that the same smoothness, which is in, say, the Street Fighter series and those type of things.
Yeah.
You know, it never occurred to me until you said that, but how many Western fighting games are there?
I used to play...
That's a good question.
Midway's all there, like War Gods and those...
Primal Rage?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Okay, so
there used to be a lot.
Like Clay Fighter and...
they're all kind of herky-jerky.
Yeah, I guess they kind of are.
Japan really kicked our ass on that one.
Don't forget the Star Wars fighting game.
Terrakazi, I was going to say that. Yeah, Masters of Terrakazi.
Yeah.
Oof. Which means, like, the... what does it mean? Like, Iron Fist or something? There's a name.
I was going to say a wart on the ass of fighting games.
Wart on the ass.
That's what that means. Anyway, I want to talk briefly about my Android pick of the week. I haven't talked about Android.
God.
Yeah.
Tablet Talk?
Yes, Tablet Talk is back with Epoch.
Yes.
Now, I know that there's some speculation sometimes that swirls around on Twitter whether dedicated portables will be around for long and whether they'll be taken over by the mobile market. And one of the things, you know, hardware capabilities, I think, are beginning to converge. But, you know, there's things like the MOGA device and game clips where you Frankenstein a PS3 controller or, you know, have a new controller to, you know, along with your game clip and phone. But I still think that that's a limited market. I see people playing games on the train, but they don't have the whole big setup, at least till Jeremy moves to LA and then he gets move controller on board.
Yeah.
So anyway, I still see two very different software experiences. I see, and I like them both. I'm not putting them down. I see the, kind of these inexpensive, a little bit shallow apps, and then I see these $30 to $40 deeper experiences that obviously involve larger budgets and larger design teams. And I think a game like Fire Emblem Awakening is possible on, say, the iPhone. I don't think anyone's making it. You know, the end result would probably be a little bit pricey. I guess installments would be.
Why do you think that is? Let me just jump in here really quickly, because that's something that I've wondered for a long time. You know, that there's not to turn this into a different conversation,
sure.
But for a long time, people have been saying like, oh, you know, the dedicated gaming console is on its way out, and you know, new smaller experiences, phone experiences are in. Why have there not been more quote-unquote real kinds of games? Like, why would you not see a, you know, something that releases on the 3DS eShop or something? Why not see those?
One of the things I think is pricing. Personally, I rarely spend more than $2 or $3. And so I think it's more of like a smaller piecemeal rather than a larger game at play there. And I think people have come to expect a low price for these things. I know when Square Enix, they put out a game and they want $8 or $15 for it, you know, the world.
I think 18 for Final Fantasy 3, if I recall.
Yeah, and people go nuts. Like, this is, you know, an arm and a leg, and you know, comparatively versus, you know, if you pay that on portable, it's an average, if not a real good price on a portable system. And so I think that points to that kind of disparity. People are used to low prices for their experience. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Do you think they do better by the dedicated platforms? I mean, you'd think if they wanted to follow the money, I mean, just by the sheer install base, why not focus some attention to, you know,
right.
Like Blue says, I mean, the buttons and the interface definitely count for something, but why not dip your toe in, you know?
I know. I think about that, too. A game like Advance War or something like that could definitely, not Nintendo's going to do it, but you don't, you know, that interface is perfectly, you could translate that into a touchscreen. It would work great, but no one's really done that. I mean, there have been, I don't know, something, Great Big War, in those type of games, but they don't quite scratch that itch. They don't have the polish of Advance Wars for me, but I'd buy it in a heartbeat.
I'm kind of surprised Ubisoft never ported the what was it, Ghost Shadows or whatever, Ghost Recon game for the 3DS.
Yeah, that would make sense.
That would have been excellent for a portable.
Yeah, makes sense.
Or, well, a phone, maybe, I should say.
Maybe there's, you know, something in the contract that it was Nintendo, I don't know, exclusive, but it would make sense to port that over. Capable. Anyway, back to Epoch. It's the closest I've seen a cover-based shooter working on mobile. It uses the Unreal Engine, and it's got a pretty hefty footprint. It's about half a gigabyte. So the game's a beast, but on a platform, getting a little bit older now, but you know, ran it on the Nexus 7, and the game runs just smooth as silk, 60 frames per second. And in a, you're a robot, you're eliminating other robots, because that's what robots do. And it really has, it's brilliant because it has this really slick interface. You start each round in cover, and when you tap on a target to kind of lock on, swiping down, and then from there it goes in different directions. If you swipe down, that initiates an optional reload. Up kind of pulls you from cover, and you start automatically firing at your designated target. Everything is swipe-based. From there, from either in cover or standing up, you can swipe left or right, and that moves you to different nodes, invisible kind of nodes. So in essence, one of the things is you have to do, you have to keep moving, and you develop this rhythm that you, so you can hit open foes, you move from grenades and from fields of fire. It reminds me, and I forgot the name right now, Blue, you probably know, PN03. For GameCube,
where it I was, love PN03. Did you know it's technically pronounced PN3?
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, it's, I can't remember where I read that, but even though it's PN03, product number 03, it's actually pronounced, if you say it out loud, it's supposed to be PN3.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Interesting bit of trivia for the listeners. Yeah.
So PN3 reminds me of that because you know, shooting towards the screen, and very much about kind of the movement and rhythm, just as much as you know, it's not necessarily about hitting a target, those type of things. There's a currency system where you can buy more effective weapons. You have, you know, grenades, missiles, power boosts, things like that. The one hook is it was $1 this week. I think it's regularly about $3. There's a $5 charge if you want to earn double currency, but I never felt the need to do that. I was earning enough. And it has missions, plenty of missions, and it has arenas where you try to last as long as possible. And just really smooth. A great example of the Unreal Engine running on Android.
So is the $5 charge a one-time thing, and then you get
yes.
your...
Yeah,
XP for, forever.
Yes,
that's it. So, what if this game came out on the 3DS eShop and it cost $7?
Would I pay for it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you know, you didn't feel the need to pay for that, but
almost,
I don't know. I was just
it
going
almost
back to the
it's really designed. The mechanics are really designed for a tablet because all you're doing is swiping, just swipe, swipe, swipe.
Yeah,
and so you could do that on the, you know, of course, the 3DS, but
Vita.
Yeah, it would work on Vita.
PlayStation minis?
It's like a mini tablet.
Which reminds me of our next game. I'm trying to move through these as fast as possible. Let's Fish Hooked On. Let's Fish. So readers will know that this week I was cursed with Super Black Bass 3D, which was, God, that game was unbearable. It tried to shoehorn these Wii-like motion controls into a 3DS game, and really the graphics were like a glass of bleach in my eyes.
Wow.
They were bad. So
damn.
After that, Let's Fish Hook On, it just seems like a game of the year contender, but I'm kidding. It's not that. It is one of the better fishing games I've played, which means overall it's probably decent. It's not great. Players, it kind of reminds me of Hot Shots Golf. You have these selection of anime-inspired characters, both sexes, and you can take them out. There's a nice variety of freshwater locales, and the environments themselves, oh, I should mention this is on Vita, they look really nice, almost too detailed, you know, in some cases, because there's a disparity between some of the building environments and then when you're underwater. From there, you choose a place to kind of cast off. You move the analog stick there, and then you swipe up to kind of cast off, and there's a power meter, much like Hot Shots, and you stop that. Really doesn't matter if you nail it or not. I don't think. I didn't see much of a difference. And there, what you're trying to do from then on is you're trying to make your lure attractive, and there's a meter at the bottom of the screen that has lure attractiveness, I believe, is the designator. And that involves kind of wiggling your you know, your directional pad or your nub around. And once the fish take the bait, there's QTEs. You either push in one of the four cardinal directions, and that's both to kind of secure the hook and to reel them in. And then there's the one problem I have with the game, the kind of the on-screen reel meter. On the right side of the screen, there is a meter to represent reeling them in. And you have to, I was using my thumb and I tried with my forefinger, and there is a icon at the bottom, and it naturally kind of drifts down there, and you have to move it up. But sometimes it doesn't really catch, and it's not an action game, so this isn't necessity, but it can be a little frustrating. From what I played, it looks good. There is some very pixelated underwater flora there. Plays decently. Can't really recommend it to anyone, but if you're a hardcore virtual angler like Blue. But I was told that it was going to drop to $9.99 fairly soon, if not already on PSN. So if you are interested in fishing games, this is probably the only one on Vita right now. And, it's above average. It's about average. Nothing great.
That's also developed by the Sega Bass Fishing Team, isn't it? Or the artist formerly known as the Sega Bass Fishing Team?
The artist? Was Prince had a hand in it?
They're only they're only represented by a symbol now. It looks a little bit like a dollar sign.
Who was it? Was it ASCII I saw on the title screen? I don't know. I'll have to look that up, Blue. But I did see, I think ASCII was the one behind it.
So I'm a little bit out of the fishing game scene.
You haven't missed anything. They haven't evolved since the Dreamcast.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So the thing is, for me, the gold standard by which all fish-based games should be measured is Odell Lake. Does anybody remember Odell Lake? One of the educational games that you used to play on, like, your elementary school, Apple II computers, the old IBMs. Come on, you guys, you should know this.
No, I don't.
Come on, listeners, someone out there must know Odell Lake. Now, you, of course, you know Oregon Trail, right?
Right, yeah.
Number Munchers?
Kind of, sort of.
So all of these games, this is not, again, a little bit of a side path here, but all of these games were...
What was the Centipede knockoff for Apple II?
Was it an educational game? Because the thing about all of these games,
it was a straight shooter.
Yeah, yeah, well, I mean, there are a ton of games that were on the Apple. I played a bunch of them. But these games in particular were all, like the Minnesota, it's MECC was the name of the developer, and it's like the Minnesota Educational Computer Corporation or something like that. They made these games specifically to be played in schools by young kids to teach them things. And Number Munchers was awesome. Oregon Trail, obviously they're still releasing Oregon Trail games.
Was like Space Invaders and math combined?
No, it was sort of like you would go around on a grid and you were this dude with this big underbite. And two little legs, and you would, like, go up, over. It would be, like, find all the things on the grid that are 6 plus 8 or something. Or find all the things that are 15. Okay. And then you would go and find, like, 7 plus 8 and 3 times 5 and stuff, and you'd munch those. And there were little troggles, or, like, these big fatty blobby guys who would try and get you.
So, like, Pac-Man with math.
A little bit, except you could move freely around this grid. You would just, it was basically like flashcards, essentially. Okay. And that's another, so the reason for bringing this up is that Odell Lake was this fish game. And all you would do was you'd be these fish, these real-life types of fish, all the way down from the smallest little chub, which is the smallest fish, which could be eaten by larger fish and would only eat algae and stuff, all the way up to the great Mackinaw trout, the largest of the predatory fish. And so this game obviously made enough of an impression on me that it is not, it's not technically an angling game. There are fishermen that you have to avoid because sometimes if you get the algae or if you get the, if the bait attractiveness is high enough, you might be angled yourself. So you have to be careful about that. But to me, that is the fish-based game.
The fishermen would come after you?
Well, yeah. So basically the concept of Odell Lake, and I love that we are talking about Odell Lake. No podcast ever has talked about Odell Lake. I defy you to find any other show that has ever talked about Odell Lake, ever. But it's one of the greats. What would happen is the gameplay here is you pick a fish that you're going to be, and each fish has different kinds of foods that it likes or dislikes, different things that predate upon it or different things that it can predate. Mm-hmm. And you basically come up to, you're on the left side of the screen, and then you would come up on something on the right-hand side of the screen, and you would have to decide if you were going to try and eat it, flee, do nothing. You'd basically decide how you were going to handle that encounter based on what you know about that fish. And sometimes the little wormies or things that you'll come across, I mean, you might go and bite them and suddenly, zhup, it turns out that it's a fisherman, and you watch your fish kind of get pulled up out of the water, and that's game over for you. Mm. You know,
I was about to say before that it sounded like Katamari, vaguely.
Well, I guess it could be the precursor by which all of those games shared DNA from Odell Lake, maybe. Yes. I guess, but anyway, so I'm just wondering.
Is there apostrophe?
I don't think so. I just think it's Odell. Lake, Odell Lake.
Yeah, I got the Lake.
And so if you look at that, it's MECC. And the interesting thing was these games made an impression on everybody who played them. So there are probably some folks out there, folks. If you hearing me right now have played Odell Lake or Number Munchers, or of course everybody's played Oregon Trail, but make a mention in the show thread, and let's all reminisce about some of these awesome games.
Together.
Yeah. So I was just kind of wondering if there have been many, you said there haven't been many enhancements in the fishing genre, but it seems like to me, kind of like golf games, it seems like the kind of thing that would be much better as a video game than as a, actually gearing up and going out to the lake and, going through all that trouble and expense and, touching the fish guts and stuff like that. So it seems like the kind of thing that really would work well as a video game, but I just don't find myself really attracted to it. The lure attractiveness is not high enough for me.
You're not hooked on it?
Not yet.
Take the bait.
Yeah.
Okay, enough puns.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm tapped out.
Yep.
Jeremy, I pass the torch to you.
Okay, so on my side, aside from reminiscing about old Minnesota educational government initiatives, actually, here's the way I'd like to approach this. I'd like to ask you, would you like the bad news first or the good news first?
I'll take the bad news.
The bad news for this show is Double Dragon 2, The Wanderer.
Yes.
Dragons. Double Dragon 2, The Wanderer Dragons. I will give you an example of how bad.
You spent good money on this.
I will recuse myself from that question, and I will take. I'm going to take the stance that nobody should be spending good money on this. I'd like to open my discussion of Double Dragon 2, The Wanderer of Dragons, with a reading of the Xbox.
Twice?
It says Double Dragon 2, The Wanderer. I don't think it's got it twice. I think it's Double Dragon 2, The Wanderer of Dragons. That's what I've got written down.
Okay. I'm just surprised that they have the word dragon appearing twice.
Double Dragon, well, it's The Wanderer, not The Dragons. It's the object, the subject of the object. Okay. So I'd like to begin by reading from the Xbox Live Marketplace description of this game. And I will tell you that my what I believed this to be was something along the lines of Double Dragon Neon, which was right. A show favorite a few episodes back. I thought that, everybody was making fun when this hit the Xbox Marketplace because of this great description, as it was on the webpage. This is a remake, Double Dragon 2, a 80s game. The storyline takes same as original game story. However, the graphic, character, action, system, etc. are changed. Also, we are including new stage and enemy in the game.
Oh.
The player will be addicted to new version of Double Dragon 2. Also, characters are undressed from 80s style and recreated with modern, sexy, and beautiful art style that amaze you and feel never been experienced world before.
Sign me up.
Yeah, so, well, the thing was, like, nobody was really sure. Like, it's so bad that they must have done it on purpose, right? No. As it happens, yeah, they updated that description. It no longer reads as like, but it was pretty clear after a few minutes with Double Dragon 2, The Wanderer of Dragons, that was pretty indicative of what the game is actually really like. I want to say before I describe it that it's...
Sexy clothes, too?
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, I guess it depends on what you like.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's maybe sexy and then you get hit in the balls with, I mean, maybe
that's sexy.
It's kind of sexy, so maybe for some people. But this game may be the worst game to be released this generation. What is the worst game you played this generation, Robert Allen?
Yaris.
I played Yaris. This is worse than Yaris. In fact, this
Hour
game
of Victory?
Is, I didn't play that one, but I will tell you the worst game.
Jeremy, for not playing.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it. The game that I, in my mind, is the worst game that I think I may ever have played, ever, is a PlayStation 2 game called Dark Angel Vampire Apocalypse.
I played that.
And was it? Did you like it?
No, it was awful.
It was the worst. It was
kind of vaguely, what was it, Gauntlet?
Kind of, but yeah, really terrible. It's been a long time since it's a gauntlet like. It's been a long time since I've played it, but in my mind, and I kept a copy of it. I actually have a copy of it. My sister gave it to me, and I kept it around at first because I just, you know, she gave it to me, and so it was special. But now I sort of keep it around because I think that everybody should keep a copy of the worst game that they've ever played, just to remind them. Just so you have something like that in your possession. I mean,
Dragons.
Maybe. But this game, Double Dragon 2 The Wandered Dragons, makes me want to go back and play Dark Angel Vampire Apocalypse just to see if it's as bad as I remember. So let's talk a little bit about this. The first thing I want to get out of the way is that they say this is a remake, Double Dragon 2, a 80s game. I assure you, it is not a remake, Double Dragon 2, a 80s game. In fact, there is nothing that I came across in Double Dragon 2 The Wanderer of Dragons that remotely reminded me of Double Dragon 2. It doesn't remake the levels. The characters are, you know... So do you remember, Robert, the plot of Double Dragon 2? So
Billy and...
That's right. Well, I believe in the opening sequence of Double Dragon 2, they are referred to as Bimmy and Jimmy Lee.
Oh, that
Yeah, but Billy and Jimmy Lee, I think, was what they meant to say. Billy and Jimmy Lee are friends now. In the original Double Dragon, you know, you were only Billy, and you found out that Jimmy... Mm-hmm. Or no, I got that right, okay. Jimmy was the, you know, the bad guy. Spoilers, by the way, sorry, people. So they're friends now in Double Dragon 2, and Billy's girlfriend, Marion, is gunned down in cold blood by... God, I don't even remember who. Anyway, she's killed, and so they go in revenge. Double Dragon 2, The Revenge, right? Am I wrong about that?
No, the Revenge. I remember.
Yeah, there was some revenge.
Wasn't it the Warriors?
Possibly. And they came out to play, and... yeah.
That was
the Warriors?
The Furies. The Furies.
Oh, the Baseball Furies. Baseball Furies. You know, I could actually talk about the Warriors for quite a while. Did you know that the Warriors is actually a retelling of the Greek Anabasis, which is about a regiment of... It's amazing. It's really good. Anyway, let's not get into that. I could talk about the Warriors.
It did seem like a journey to the underworld. You know,
actually, the original Anabasis was a story about this regiment that was separated from an invasion or something, and they have to fight their way back out when their leader is killed, which is basically the plot of The Warriors, the movie. Interesting other little bit of trivia about The Warriors, the movie. Did you know that the radio lady who sort of, she serves as the Greek choir, you know, sort of telling you know, that's actually Lynn Thigpen, who was formerly the chief in... the Carmen Sandiego TV show.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know where
you're
all this...
getting learned on this podcast.
Here's the thing. I just want to do anything except talk about Double Dragon 2, The Wanderer of Dragons. So the game is roughly a brawler in the style of Double Dragon, but nothing really works. You can sort of hit guys, but they'll basically... kill you every time. There are no real combos to speak of, and the guys will gang up on you, which wouldn't be bad if you could actually hit a few guys at the same time, but you kind of really can't. And I've never been quite sure whether that is because of jank controls or if it's because of this stamina bar that they added to the game, which actually I was kind of interested in at first, because I'm not sure if any brawlers have stamina bars that I can think of. I mean, I know there are like special abilities that you can... Mm-hmm. limited amount of, but in this you actually have a stamina bar for things like jumping and kicking and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, all right, okay. In actual practice, though, what ends up happening is basically any given move that you do depletes your stamina bar so much that I don't know if you just can't attack after. I never really actually figured this out. Because it seemed like really hit and miss whether I would even do these attacks to begin with. The game is functional, more or less. I mean, it's not broken. I mean, it doesn't crash or anything like that, but you're just always struggling with everything. And maybe it's this really like brilliant commentary on, you know, fist fighting and maybe, I don't know.
Futility of violence.
it's like the next Heavy Rain, you know, where everything was just difficult because of the, you know, I don't know.
So Jonathan Blow worked on it?
Maybe. I don't know who worked on this, but I feel kind of bad for him.
A Korean organization by the name of Gravity. They've created some MMOs, and let me look them up right now. Ragnarok Online.
I am a little conflicted on how to feel about them as a group, because I know that stuff in game development can be challenging, man. I mean, I know that the stuff that seems easy can be really, really difficult. But this game probably shouldn't have passed whatever certification it had to go through. I mean, it is not doing credit to the developer, to anybody who's involved with it, to Microsoft. This is right now an Xbox exclusive, I think, and hopefully they can contain this so that everyone else doesn't get infected with it. But
this was a $15 download.
It's expensive. Yeah, like and you know, people, especially, like I said, I was thinking, oh, ha ha ha, this funny description, like this must be sort of a tongue-in-cheek, sort of weird Englishy, you know, winner is you kind of experience, and maybe it's really going to be good, like, you know, because even Double Dragon Neon was very self-aware about the 80s and stuff, and like air guitar and like really cornball stuff that you just love to love. But this is just really bad, and you can tell right from the beginning. I mean, the tutorial is weird. There's a narrator that kind of doesn't really say what the subtitles are saying.
they just do their own thing.
It's like vaguely kind of related. Like it must have gotten translated at some point, or maybe the localization people weren't together on the recording versus what they were wanting to. I don't know. It's really baffling. One thing I will say about it, though, is the cutscenes in between. They have kind of like this animated sort of dynamic animation kind of style where things might swirl or glow or something like that. Those actually look really cool. And the music, I want to go back and play a little bit. There is one thing that is related to Double Dragon 2 The Revenge, which is the music is vaguely kind of remixed, some of the tracks anyway. Not all of them, but I did. I don't know if you remember, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this on this podcast. The music to Double Dragon 2 kind of went do 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 da 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 da. I don't know if you remember that, but as I was like tearing out my hair and gouging my eyes out playing this game, I actually heard a little bit of that music in the tracks that we're playing.
So they paid homage to the original soundtrack?
A little bit, yeah. So at least there's something there that is, I mean, maybe the music person, and it wasn't what I would call like it was nothing on the level of Double Dragon Neon, because that was just choice music, but at least I heard it, and it was in there, and I want to at least mention that, because
that's Jake Kaufman who did that one, who's exceptional.
Yes, over Way Forward, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in The Wanderer of Dragons, there is at least somebody over there who at least had played Double Dragon 2 at some point, and I want to shout them out, because good job, music guy, who made some okay music that kind of sounds like Double Dragon 2. It feels like, overall, it kind of feels like a student game, which I kind of feel bad saying that, because students out there are going to feel bad that I said that. It's not that I want to disparage student games. It just has that feel. Like, stuff hasn't quite come together yet, it's like feature complete, but
it's when people have a semester to work on stuff instead of years.
Kind of. I mean, this is, you know, they say, alpha build is feature complete, nothing's really working. I mean, this is alpha, it's feature complete, but nothing really is working. And, you know, the interesting thing, too, is I have to admit that I did not play much of this. I played as much as I actually almost tried to cut it short. One of the funny things about this is that they actually give you something like 20 lives. Well, no, it's not 20 lives. It's 20 continues. So I think they do 2 or 3 lives per continue. And you have these little tokens, these little coins. Then you start out with like 20 of them. And if you die enough, which you will do pretty much over and over again. I mean, there is no rhyme or reason to the combat. You can't counter anything. There's a block button, but you can't really block with it, because people just hit you anyway, so you're trying to figure it out. Like, sometimes I'll just randomly... And they have that... you remember that jumping cyclone kick in Double Dragon 2?
Oh, like, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, there's kind of like a special move, and I don't even remember if it... You know, I got to admit, I don't even remember if the cyclone move is the actual special move that you do in this or not. It kind of feels like it is, but I'm trying to...
Dude, the NES version, that got me through the whole game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And in this, and I have to say, there's at the beginning, there's this whole thing about, you know, this kind of kung fu is good and this kind of kung fu is bad. I have heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that if you use the special move at all in this game, you can't actually get the best ending. I cannot corroborate that, but it sounds right to me based on what else I've played with this. But there are like 20 continues, and you'll burn through them pretty quick. And at one point, I was like, oh, I'm just gonna like I can't keep doing this. You know, I was just like counting down the timer, and then I'd like, okay, I'll continue. I can do this. I mean, there's potentially an idea in this game of something that could be good, but it's just so bad. It just hurts. Hmm.
Worst brawler ever. Double Dragon 2, Wanderer of the Double Dragons.
The Wanderer of Dragons, yeah.
I like to throw that double in there, just for redundancy.
The Wanderer of the Double Dragons. Yes. The Revenge. So I do want to go and track down the, you know, maybe somebody's got the score, the musical score on YouTube, mm-hmm. and kind of see if there was any more to it from that
standpoint.
So
maybe you should do a post-mortem. What happened here? What went?
Man, I kind of wonder, you know, did you ever hear Jerry Seinfeld talk about people in a bad movie? Like, do they know they're in a bad movie? I'm sure these people know. I'm sure they know what kind of a game they made. And they released it anyway, and they're charging a lot of money for it. And I think it's only by the fact that Double Dragon Neon was released not so long ago. I mean, I thought, until mm-hmm. I actually played this and saw it, I thought that it was related to Double Dragon Neon somehow. And I suspect that is how they are going to get the majority of their sales, is, you know, trading on other people's work.
Good game.
Yeah, exactly. So avoid this one.
According to the Wikipedia, guess how long it was in development, Jeremy? Oh,
God. 8 weeks.
3 years.
Wow. How I don't know. I just don't know what to say. Like, I just don't like to disparage people because I don't know what they were going through. Did you say it was a South Korean? Were they North Koreans or South Koreans?
Maybe I'm assuming South.
Probably Korea. South Koreans. Was that?
Are you saying it's a?
Well, anyhow.
They launched a missile into the eyes of gamers, into the eyes of hearts. That was insensitive.
No, it wasn't. I spent way more time on that. I just wanted to really just drive it into people's brains to not give this thing a second thought. Is it just as a curio,
check out the demo at least, just to see how bad it is?
Maybe. But I wonder if you could really get the true depth of badness from even the demo. I think you'll just have to take my word on this, folks. There are a lot of reviews out there, though, too. You know, don't take my word for it, as LeVar Burton would say. Go out and do some reading. Butterfly in the Sky. I read some reviews. It's really bad. So that was the bad news. How would you like to hear about the good news?
I love bad news.
Well, I have some news that's like okay news. So let's work up to it. So I have some okay news. So the bad news.
The lukewarm news.
Yeah, the lukewarm news. Lukewarm news is I've also been playing another game on the Xbox. I've been playing Battle Block Theater.
Oh,
which
that's lukewarm?
It's lukewarm for me, and let me talk about a little bit why that is. The first thing about Battle Block Theater is it suffered a little bit to me from the same thing that Wander of Dragons did, in that I had kind of some misconceptions about it before I actually played it. There was that one trailer, and I don't know if you saw more at pre-release assets about this than I did, but for a long time all I had was, you know, the vague, this is a game from the Behemoth, so this is from mm-hmm. the people who did your Alien Hominid, your Castle Crashers, actually those may be it, Alien Hominid.
They did an iPhone app, which is the mini game where you're, what's the Soviet missile crash? It's one of the mini games.
Alien Hominid?
Yes.
Yeah, there's the Soviets in Alien Hominid, but anyway, so this I guess is their third game, and it is published by Microsoft Studios, so this is an Xbox exclusive, and the only thing I had to go on for a long time with this game was the trailer where they showed kind of just really vague, you know, like the guy wearing the hat with the tears streaming down and like gems mm-hmm. and some jumping and stuff like that. So I didn't really know what this was. I thought that what this was going to be was a brawler. Let me clarify that. Kind of a Smash Brothers brawl, you know, Super Smash Brothers brawl, PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale, God, Beautiful Joe, Red Hot Rumble, which I don't know why I brought that up, but it's of that type of game. And that's what I thought this was going to be, was, you know, three or four players or online or whatever, you know, getting gems and smashing people down and things like that. But it's actually not. And what it is isn't bad. It's just not what I expected. Battle Block Theater is actually a pure puzzle platformer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the three-piece, pure puzzle platformer. And it is essentially made up of simple blocks that, mm-hmm. that are just different kinds of blocks. So you have, normal, walking surfaces. You may have traps or teleporters or springboards. You may have, there's verticality to these levels. So you may, go up and down and I think I mentioned teleporters. There are force fields, lots of little gadgets, wings that you can get to flutter around. And the entire idea of this game is that you basically are just trying to work your way through just individual little levels and get to the end after having collected a sufficient number of these gems to open the exit, basically. Okay. And that's essentially the idea of it. Your character, you have many different characters that you can choose from. Lots of unlocks in this game. Obviously, anybody who's played, definitely Castle Crashers anyway, mm-hmm. is familiar with just, they love to do unlocks. And there, there's a lot of incentive there to, get just a few more gems or to replay a level and get that one that you just couldn't really take the time to get the last time you played it, but so you kind of go through it again and try and grind for gems. The actual play of the game is very simple. Like your characters are not super powered. You have very, it almost reminds me a little bit of like Spelunky kind of. You have sort of limited mobility except in the environmental things in the game. Like I said, the springboards, the wings, but your character just in and of himself, they kind of look like little, they look like they're wearing like onesie pajamas kind of, and then you have little customizable heads that you can get. The style of the game is very cute, very, the style that people associate with the behemoth, Dan Paladin, I believe is the name of the creator. And I will say that the style of the game is much, much better than what I make it to sound like. In fact, I have to say, so the game opens with a little story, a little cutscene opening intro showing Hattie Hattington, who is the leader of a bunch of friends. They're basically on a ship. They're on the friendly ship of friends or something like that. And Hattie Hattington is the friendliest friend of all. And they end up in a storm and they crash on this island and they're basically all abducted and forced to do these sort of what, like Running Man style entertainment, death races for these evil cats. And that opening cutscene, that intro is so much fun. There's actually a narrator in Battle Block Theater who is sort of a, I don't know, kind of like a milk toast sort of, Mr. Hattie Hattington was the friendliest friend of all kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And it is way fun to listen to this narrator talk about, and he'll also narrate a little bit in the, as you're playing as well, like, oh, guess that didn't work or whatever. And, just all kinds of little things here and there, little quippy things. And it's way fun to listen to this narrator. Actually, for my money, I think the narrator in this is probably better than the narrator in Bastion, but just in terms of, and I'll tell you, I may have talked about it on the show before, but I did not really dig the narrator in Bastion that much.
Was it what he said or how he spoke?
It was just that I think he was a little bit overhyped in Bastion. To me, the thing about Bastion, a lot of people were talking about the narrator, like the narrator was the thing. The kid got up and got out of bed, but oh, then he got lost and turned left. Whatever it was that he said. But to me, I didn't find that to be the most interesting thing about Bastion at all, really. Okay. It was kind of an interesting little curiosity, and yeah, it worked, and it was kind of cool. Like, he was a character, and it was retelling the story. But to me, the neat thing about Bastion, we won't get into it, but the neat thing to me about Bastion was the ability to customize your own difficulty levels. That was one particular that game, which to me was extremely inventive at the time. I don't remember a lot of games really doing it in that same way. You can basically determine your own risk reward. I want my enemies to be stronger. I want to have to, lots of different things. You could go to the temple and say, basically set your own parameters for how difficult you wanted it to be, and then you would get more stuff if you did that. But anyway, the narrator in Battle Block Theater, I think, is just a hoot to listen to. And just in all the cutscenes, the story unfolds of how Hattie Hattington is. They put this evil hat on him, and he's the one in charge of making all of these friends fight to the death. And Hattie Hattington wouldn't do this, would he? So just a lot of fun. But the feel of the game is somewhat like a cross between, I want to say, like The Binding of Isaac, sort of in its sort of cute, sinister sort of way, versus something like Load Runner, maybe, where again everything is just arranged into blocks that have certain properties. There's actually a level editor in this game, which is kind of neat, because when you look at you sort of in the same way that something like Little Big Planet, they make the entire game out of bits that you have access to. Same thing in Battle Block Theater, except you can sort of get the idea of how you can build your own levels. I mean, there was a level editor in Load Runner, in the old Load Runner, and I mean, that was probably the most user-generated content I think I ever made, was making my own levels in Load Runner, which, again, also on the Apple II, so this thing is all coming full circle here.
Jeremy.
Yeah, but the levels are really inventive. Like, using just a simple number of blocks, or simple types of blocks, you know, there are false walls, there are spikes. Like I said at the beginning, it's pure platforming. Mm-hmm. It really is. They use a lot of creative little ways to, you know, you've got to figure out some way to traverse this stuff. And I feel like they have taken probably, you know, when they make games like this, I'm assuming that they probably just have everybody just throw out ideas and throw out levels, and then they find the ones that they like that have great ideas, and they refine those into something that eventually goes into the final game. And it feels like they got the best of the best, you know, in this. Starts out pretty straightforward, pretty simple, but the further on you go, it can get pretty taxing, pretty darn difficult. The game is also multiplayer, but since I choose not to pay Microsoft for online play, I could only play single player. All the levels are doable single player, but I kind of wanted to get the idea for what this was. Again, when I figured out that it wasn't a brawling style game, I watched some video of some people playing, and you can actually do some pretty neat things. I think one of the things that Behemoth had sort of talked about was the ability to sort of play cooperative competitively, kind of, where you could sort of troll your friends, and, you know, you might be holding a switch that, you know, throws up a force field between a, you know, little fire spout, but you know, just as soon as they walk over, you throw the switch again and toast them. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of cooperative stuff, like you can actually pick up the other character and throw them pretty far. You can reach down if you're on top of something tall and they can't quite hop up and double jump up there. You can actually reach down and pull them up and throw them up behind you and that sort of thing. And the game is very, there's not a lot of punishment in this game. So I think I mentioned that it gets pretty difficult, but it's the kind of game that is very forgiving in that, you know, for example, if there's a gem that is sitting on top of a, you know, lava pit or something like that, mm-hmm. you can actually jump, grab the gem, fall into the lava and die, and still respawn wherever your last respawn point was, and it still counts. So mm-hmm. they're not very interested in really punishing you when something gets too difficult. If you can find a way to finagle something, either solo or co-op, they'll basically let you do it. And they give you grades at the end of each level, however many gems you collected. Did you do it in a certain time limit? You're also collecting balls of yarn. And between levels, you can go and unlock using the gems that you've collected or using the balls of yarn for the really extra special unlocks. You can release other prisoners who are characters that you can play as. You know, the attacks that you do are pretty simple. You have like a little kind of a pushy sort of thing, very impotent little sort of shove that you can do. You can do this little, you know, down hit that, you know, doesn't really do much. So you'll run into these levels that's not just environmental. There are these little secret service cats in there that'll throw grenades, or they'll, mm-hmm. you know, they'll try and push you around, but you can sort of push them back. Mm-hmm. And you have these little projectiles that you can do, like paper airplanes or little discs and things. But most of the game is really based on the platforming. And like I said, it's a pure platformer. There aren't a lot of those, it seems like, these days. I mean, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, because I know there's always a lot of stuff out there that I'm not thinking of. But most of the time, platformers are also, you know, something else. You know, action platformers, fighting platformers, things like that. This is probably the closest to a really pure platformer that I've played in quite a long time. And so for people
what
who
would you call Mario?
Mario is definitely a platformer. To me, Mario is a platformer, the whole idea. But this, again, is you know, whereas with Mario, you had a pretty clear idea, like, okay, I can make that jump, I can't make that jump. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned at the beginning, puzzle platform, because you're never quite sure. And mm-hmm. they've structured the level so that you might just charge into something and, you know, jump on a launcher or jump on a little toasty cinder mm-hmm. Block that, you know, you sort of like Super Mario 64. If you touch the lava, woohoo! You know, he jumps up high, you know, with his hot tush, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, his hot Mario tush, looking good in those overalls. But same sort of thing. So some of the environmental things will not kill you, but that you'll use those to like reach an extra high area because it was a hot coal or something like that. So the same kind of thing here. Like, you might actually just start running through something, and they'll structure it so that if you have the presence of mind to just point in the right direction, you might be able to get through it on your first try, but it's very puzzly. And I do like that about it, the fact that it's not just a, you know, because just plain old platforming, you know, like, it's okay, right. You know, and maybe that's the reason you don't see a lot of them, is it's like, okay, well, I can jump up to this other thing, or I can teleport, but in this, you never quite know until you've died a couple of times, like, how does this actually work? Like, how am I actually going to get up there? And that is something that, like I said, I don't see a lot of, and I feel like there's some value in that. So like I said, kind of the okay news, Battle Block Theater, not what I expected, not terrible, not even bad. I mean, it's good. But I'm not sure that it's going to really be for everyone. I'm still kind of out on whether or not I really like it. I think the more time I spend with it, the more I like it, but are people really going to give it that chance? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not, but again, the multiplayer is probably a big part of it. And that is something that I will probably never experience, unfortunately. And so if you have friends that are going to be playing this with you, which again, I don't know, are you going to have that multiplayer experience that's so great and fun? I don't know. I mean, they've designed it to be that way, but are a lot of people going to be playing this, or a lot of people, you know, going to be playing it? Mm-hmm. I don't know. So you probably have to kind of love it for what it is. And then hopefully find some other like-minded people to enjoy it with you. So, Battle Block Theater.
The expiration date for games these days is relatively short. I picked up Skulls of the Shogun. Tried to get a few matches online. Not too much luck. Had to wait a little while.
I'll play Skulls of the... Oh, nope. I guess I won't. I guess I won't ever play Skulls of the Shogun with you, Robert.
Why?
You know, interesting, because I'm not going to pay him for gold.
Oh, for gold? I'm not sorry.
For Xbox Live Gold. I'm sorry. You know what? That's
no, that's fine. That's your prerogative.
And it would be way fun, I'm sure, but you know, I'm just not. It's just not going to get me the value that I need. I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about. I'm going to play with Deagle. I'm going to play Skulls of the Shogun, and then schedules not permitting, whatever. I'm going to go through the whole year again, because I've been down this road a couple times, going through the whole year, not actually doing anything with it, and there goes that money. So. Yep. Interesting thing about Skulls of the Shogun, though. Did you know that the best-selling version of that was on Windows Phone?
Not surprised, considering Windows 8. I don't think they sold too many SKUs on that.
No, but I mean, I would have assumed that the Xbox would have been the highest-selling SKU. But part of it may also be the price, too, because I think it's only $7 or $8 on Windows Phone.
Mm-hmm.
But I just saw an article about that.
Seems like that would be kind of a standout purchase on Windows Phone. I mean, I've seen some good games, but that would definitely be a kind of a showpiece, and I'd love to play that on portable.
Really good and a lot of fun.
Yeah. Okay. I have a feeling what your good news is going to be.
The good news this
Guacamelee.
Guacamelee.
Yes.
Guacamelee is great news. And I know you've also played it, so I wouldn't. I would like you to chime in on this as well. But Guacamelee is. I'm
tasty.
Sure. First of all, the name Guacamelee. Come on, this has got to be one of those things where someone came up with the name Guacamelee and then they had to design something around it. So Guacamelee, of course,
so name before design, Doc.
I can only imagine, man. I mean, come on, with a name like Guacamelee, you've got to use it. I mean, they were out to lunch at one day, and one of the guys there one of the guys
speech.
At Drinkbox, they were out at, like, you know, Mexican lunch or something, and somewhere
in Toronto,
like, Guacamelee. Guacamelee, and they're like, damn it, guys, we've got to come up with something right now for this. So Guacamelee is completely based around Lucha Libre, Mexican wrestling, and Dia de los Muertos. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe they came up with that first and somebody just had the brilliance to come up with Guacamelee, but I feel like the name probably came first. Guys at Drinkbox, correct me. It's got to be that came first.
I'm going to take the other side.
Yeah. So Guacamelee is a. I'm not going to use the word.
No, do it.
No, I'm not going to do it.
Just because someone in my review said, could there be a review that doesn't say Metroidvania?
It is one of those. And, you know, I'm going to find out about this because I believe that there was a Metroid style game that came out before Metroid. And I believe it was a Ninja Turtles game. I've got to look this up. I've got to do a little research into this. But
how about the
anyway,
Goonies? Goonies 2?
Was Goonies before Metroid?
No, it probably wasn't. I take that.
I think there was something that came out before Metroid. We'll look it up. But anyway, it is a Metroidvania game, which is
Mescalvania.
Yeah.
Because he does, he's an agave farmer.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so it starts out and you're just a lowly agave farmer making your tequila and, you get no respect and... you can actually
the Rodney Dangerfield of your little town.
Kind of, you know, and even his posture, like, I guess he still gets this when he turns into the luchador, but, you know, he's like got this, like, his head is sort of like kind of like hunched over. He's kind of like, he's just some
he's kind of hulking and menacing when he has the mask on. It changes
kind of
changes
yeah,
slightly.
But he just has like this straight face too, like just this unamused sort of look to him, you know, heavy eyebrows, you know. But anyway, so the game is 2D with, you know, sort of. I think it even more than Metroid. I mean, it reminds me a lot more of Castlevania 2. The way the game is, so it's a 2D game, but you sort of have different little areas that you can go to depending on if you take an exit through, you know, a high portion of a particular area, a low portion of a particular area. And of course, sections are blocked off with different limitations.
Colored gates, yeah.
Yeah, either colored gates or something is too high to jump up to, or, you know,
you can't fit through.
Yeah, exactly. Something may be too small and crunchy. You may come up to a giant rock face that basically just stops you and you can't go up or anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so this character Juan is, he becomes a luchador, and the luchador, he of course gains the power of Lucha Libre, where you can do some simple little combos, basically punching, jumping, there's some grappling. If you hit an enemy and stun them, you can eventually hit triangle button, throw them, and it starts out, and there's also a dodging mechanic too, so pretty simple, pretty straightforward. And at first I was not very impressed by this, and I'd like to stress to people that if you play Guacamelee and are not impressed by the first, you know, little combat that you do, until you get to the second town, because we shouldn't go too far without saying that this game is much like the Mutant Blobs Attack and Tales from Space About a Blob. The game is full of little tongue-in-cheek references.
Oh my god, yeah. Yeah.
I'm kind of coming around on this. I don't know if you remember, but when I talked about Retro City Rampage, I think I mentioned the sheer fatigue that I got from the number of references just constantly in every.
I don't know if you said fatigue. I thought you were more overwhelmed. Agreed that we were just overwhelmed because it almost drove us out of the narrative because it just bombarded us.
Yeah, and I say that fatigue in the sense that I just got really tired. Like literally, my body became tired trying to absorb all of the references. Okay. I have kind of come around a little bit, and on Guacamelee,
they're not quite as. They don't hit you over the head as River City.
I don't know about that, though. I mean, they're everywhere. If you go through that town, every single billboard, kind of like in Mutant Blob Attack, every single billboard is a reference to either a game or a, you know, website or an internet meme
which just brings up a sticky little ethical situation.
I kind of wonder, like, maybe they all find it kind of cute, and, you know.
When you have Mr. Destructoid and Giant Bomb kind of stuff. How do you evaluate when your website is predominantly featured in the game?
Yeah, but, the same thing with Retro City Rampage. Like, all the, you know, there were some of the characters, the actual characters.
That's right,
You know, but the same thing here. So the website's like, I don't know so much about, but they'll have, and they're all made into like luchadors. So the thing is, I don't want to talk about too much about what they are because like everybody else on Twitter, like it's fun to like take a little screenshot and be like, I get this joke, but it's kind of fun to just like find them for yourself.
Yep.
And
I shouldn't have said that.
No, it's all right. I think it's important to bring some of those things up. But the one that I will say again, it's a very Metroid reference. The you unlock the different statues. Mm-hmm. There are some very Aztec looking versions of the Metroid Chozo statues. And I think they missed a step here because they didn't call it chorizo. I don't know why they didn't call it chorizo.
You know, I thought the same thing.
Why did they not call him chorizo? It's the one thing that I have a problem with.
I think that would have been too stereotypical.
Yeah, it could be. You know what, though? There are some things in this. I mean, it's very charming.
It would have been a little sexualized.
They throw a lot of little Spanish terms and they're very fun, but sometimes like the second player, like this is a two-player game, and the second player is this lucha lady, and her name is Tostada.
Yeah. That was disappointing.
Which I kind of, sometimes, like, I'm trying to be a lot more sensitive about that sort of thing, and it's mostly funny, and it's very charming, and you can tell that they use Spanish terms and, you know, in the right way, and like that, but then it's like Tostada.
Yeah.
Yeah, like,
that was a little.
So there is a little bit of that.
I missed maybe a side mission where they have some jokes about her name.
Do they?
Somebody
talks about eating
tostadas all night.
Oh, that could be. Maybe I'm
I don't know.
Anyway, chorizo. They should have called them chorizos. But the let's see. Where was I going with this? There was something I was going to do. References. The combo chicken. So in Second Town, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the combat, because it starts out very simple and you're like, ah, this is kind of lame, like punch, punch, and I got to go chase the guy down after I punch him too far. But in the Second Town, there is a character called the Combo Chicken, who teaches you how to take this very simple combat mechanic and to string together some really impressive combos. And when I say combos like that, it makes me want to laugh at myself. But Combo Chicken. So you eventually will unlock, so like Robert was saying earlier, you have different little, you know, colored areas that are blocked off, and you can only use certain kinds of attacks to get through them, but they are also combat techniques. So one of the first ones you get, for example, is a like an uppercut kind of thing, which will also sort of lift you off the ground a little bit. And you can use that at first as a traversal technique so that you can jump up to something that you know, can't reach just with a jump, but then you uppercut and you can get over. So you feel like you're sort of gaming the system in the way that those older games would sort of do. So I'm sure they did that very mindfully. And there are especially some puzzles later on where, again, in the platforming way, where you can only get through things by doing that kind of thing, dropping
and
down.
And really, my favorite part about combat, and as it moved later on, was that it wasn't, it still challenged you in manipulation of the sticks, but it was really about threat assessment. I don't want to say too much, but there's auras, different colored auras that you would have to, you have to damage with a certain move, and you really have to sit down and focus into what, you know, what is the biggest threat right now, and in what order do I take these out, and what is the best route. And so combat was actually pretty thoughtful.
Yeah, and then, you know,
it wasn't just, you know, button mashy. You really had to sit down.
Yeah, and you eventually sort of figure out a combo that you like. And I mean, I just can't say enough about that Combo Chicken. That really unlocked.
You really like that.
I love the Combo Chicken. Everybody get the Combo Chicken. No, but I really appreciated that, because it really opened up the game for me. And that was the point at which I realized that there was something here that I could be doing. It was just really good.
Did you play it in co-op?
I did. Yeah. So a couple things about so there is two players. I also want to mention here, the game is both on the PlayStation 3 and on the Vita, and it is a cross-buy game. So if you buy one, you get them both, and you can play two players local co-op. But you can either do it two players through the controllers, or there is they've mentioned it, and I know that this information is out there, but I don't know that they really document it that well. This game actually supports the Vita as a controller for the PlayStation 3 version, and kind of in the same way that the Wii U might do that sort of thing. And I will tell you,
I'm laughing because Jeremy did not read my review.
Undocumented. In terms of how to do it,
right?
I mean, they just don't, like, it's not explicit. Okay. They don't tell you. I mean, they don't really tell you that you can do it. It's just something that you sort of get from either their website or promotional things or reviews on tech-gaming.com. but, like, how to actually do it. So I'm going to tell you right now how to do it. You load up the game on your PlayStation 3, turn off your controller, and then use your Vita to do remote play. There is an option for cross-controller on the Vita, but don't do that. Just do regular remote play as long as you have Guacamelee actually loaded up, and it'll just blip, it'll just... Yep. Log you right on, and at that point you're using the Vita. The controls they basically map directly over. And I believe I don't think there's anything in the rear touch, but the Vita then becomes a real-time map or sort of overview of the area that you're in, which this is really the way to play it. This is the way the 1% plays Guacamelee, and I highly recommend it, because in the same way that the game, you know, you have to sort of backtrack a lot to figure out where it is that you've been, you can see everything on this mini-map without having to go to a separate screen. And so I found lots of little secrets this way, things that I wouldn't have found otherwise, and it just works really well. And even the, you know, the button controls, like I didn't feel like I was hampered in any way. The other thing is, if you're playing it co-op that way, you can actually use kind of a bubble mechanic in the same way that Super Mario Brothers Wii or the Wii U version also kind of has a bubble thing where. So I was actually playing with I played with both my wife and my kids. And so in sections that were a little platforming heavy, because this thing eventually gets into some Super Meat Boy territory.
Yeah.
Like there are some real, like,
side,
you
missions,
know,
yep.
Buzz saws and spikes and things like that. Moving platforms.
And then the one thing we didn't talk about is the polarity shift between the world of the living and world of the dead.
That's right. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yep.
Which is. Really complicates things, because you might have to jump towards a wall, shift between the different worlds, bounce off the wall, you know, hit a platform. Because you can only hit certain enemies when you're in one of those worlds. So
right, fighting also uses that as well. So yeah. and they really sort of ease you into that stuff as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you can do that with the Vita, and it just works really well. So, like I said, that is the way to play it. Want to talk a little bit about the art. Art is awesome, very detailed. Yes. Like I said, the way to play it on the PlayStation 3, if you have a big TV, because you can see it, it's, you know, very detailed. The Vita looks great, but it's just so tiny. And if you have the ability to get the best of both worlds, just do that. Just, like I said, just play it on the PlayStation 3 with your Vita. The music
be the 1%.
Awesome. Yeah, be the 1%.
Occupy. Oh, no, that would be the 99%. Occupy Guacamole. Yeah.
The music in this is so great. I cannot wait for some soundtrack to become available. I would classify this as like mariachi remix kind of music. And when you shift back and forth between the worlds, like the music in the world of the dead will get a little muted or will change a little bit. And, you know, sometimes there's vocals that you get in the land of the living that, you know, don't carry over. So, you know, I just can't say enough good things about it.
Dig into Guacamelee.
Dig in. You get an extra side of Guacamelee, maybe.
Cleanse your palate first.
That's right. Yeah. So good stuff. Guacamelee, the best news this week.
So let's talk to Leo from Wired Productions right now. Robert here. Today I'm being joined by Leo Zolo, Managing Director at Wired Productions. Welcome to the show, Leo.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Now, before we begin talking about your current project, I wanted to talk a little about some of Wired Productions' body of work. Now, I'm sure listeners are well acquainted with your efforts. You were the marketing force behind Trackmania Sunrise, Painkiller, Hell and Damnation, Divine Divinity, one title I really liked, Freedom Force versus the Third Reich, Pro Rugby Manager 2.
You've really gone through the archives.
Well, I'm sure I missed a few essential titles in there as well.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I've worked over 100 titles in the last, I guess, 18 years I've been in the industry. So it's been a good 18 years.
Are there any you're particularly proud of?
Gosh.
Stand out.
I mean, stand out. I mean, obviously the EJ, I know we're going to talk about it, but the EJ products are brilliant. Yeah. Trackmania, very good. Good community product. My favourites really, Cossacks and Sunstrike. They were great products as well as great community products. Lots. I mean, Divinity franchise. To be honest, I helped work on the early products, and it's good to see Larian take over and do a tremendous job with that. I mean, the paths within the industry are very interlinked, so it's good to see, you know, fellow colleagues and partners doing really well now, so it's good. But yeah, lots of titles.
Yeah, sounds that way. Now, you mentioned the EJ license, and one thing I know Wired Productions have been instrumental in the Wii Sing franchise. Can you tell us a little bit about your company's involvement in that project?
Yes, sorry, I didn't even mention the biggest thing that we've been working on for the last 5 years. We partnered up with a publisher called Nordic Games about 5 years ago, and we were their production arm, basically producing, co-developing, managing anything to do with their product pipeline. And one of the ideas that we sort of came up with and pitched to the guys was Wii Sing, a singing game on the Nintendo Wii, sort of similar to SingStar. We did the first one back in 2009 and was a huge success. So as with all good successes, you quickly start working on sequels. So we did that, We Sing Encore. And basically, I think we've done about 8 SKUs so far, including one with Robbie Williams. Mm-hmm. We've pop hits, rock hits, 80s. I think we just launched in the US, or Nordic Games just launched We Sing Pop in the US a few months ago. So it's very good franchise. We're now working on the Voice branded products as a developer, so it's publisher role, but it was development role. So
in the States, you mentioned we just received We Sing Pop, and that's not quite the case in Europe, where vocalists, you know, they got, as you mentioned, 8 different games based on musical genres. Now, the million-dollar question is, if you could speculate why karaoke-styled games just don't seem to have the same impact in the United States as other parts of the world. I love them myself, but my countrymen don't seem to dig them as much.
I can't answer that 100%. Yeah. Just a few thoughts, but I mean, in they're very much social party games, and you know, post drink or just group of girls, and you know, it's where the there is a long casual market. Now, US is kind of a little bit more street and a little bit more cutting edge and a little bit more hardcore in terms of the formats and everything else. To be fair, some brands have done reasonably well in the US. Karaoke Revolution's been one. But SingStar, for example, didn't do really well. So,
that's one of my favorites too.
It's just a good product,
Well, currently, Wired is in the process of kickstarting EJ Pure, and that's an adaptation of the prominent music creation suite that allowed budding musicians to create, I think it was like dance, hip-hop, techno tracks, had this convenient drag-and-drop interface, and just this huge library of pre-built sounds, almost a music construction set, if you will. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the rights, or securing the rights to the EJ brand.
Sure. As part of my history, in 97, I helped launch Dance EJ into the UK and worked with Helmut, the owner of EJ. We licensed it for the UK then and did a good job. Together with the team at Fast Track, I had a very good team around me, or with me. I was part of the team. We launched the first one, Dance EJ, went to number one. We did Rave EJ, it was called then, which then subsequently went on to become Techno EJ. We did that. We did Hip Hop EJ. We worked on, I think, 3 or 4 years worth of EJ products. So we firmly established the brand in the UK. And to be honest, the UK helped other territories. So it was it was good grounding for the franchise in general. I've known Helmut, the owner, since 97, and obviously we've got a good track record together. And I've been keeping an eye on EJ, seeing if it was a physical son or a physical baby, it'd be nearly 18 now. So, so I've been keeping track on sort of EJ and all the story that went with it, and saw that it went to a publisher called Empire back in 2003, and still kept monitoring it. And Empire Interactive sadly went into administration, I guess, in 2009. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, Helmut managed to secure the rights, bought back the rights from the administrator, and has been sitting on the rights and the IP and the tech whilst trying to work out a plan, I guess, and finding some bandwidth to deal with it. Now, we started talking, I guess, probably about 10 months ago now, 11 months ago now. And we have a good understanding of what EJ's about. It's deeply embedded in our company's DNA, my DNA. And with Helmut, we had a great conversation in terms of what needed to be done with it. So we licensed the IP to bring back EJ, really. Now, the idea really was to bring it back to tablet form first, and then build the success around it. Now, the thinking of it really is, when Dance EJ first launched, sort of 97, it was for the mass market. It was for the, not really music professionals. It was for people who didn't really have an understanding of music, wanted to get into it, or just didn't know they wanted to get into it, and were pushed into it, and they realized they enjoyed it. And that audience is well, that mass market now are on the mobile. So we wanted to replicate that experience, but on the modern day format, which is tablets and mobiles.
Now, that balance is something that I'd like to explore. Now, I'm someone who enjoyed creating their own kind of embarrassingly awful garage and drum and bass tracks with, I think it was EJ Club World for the PS2. And I found that the early iterations of the series, they stuck a really good balance between user-friendliness and capability. And I know that there were more advanced suites out there, you know, things like Fruity Loops that offered more power, but they were also exponentially more complicated. And I wonder, how are you attacking that balance for EJ Pure between those two?
Sure. The philosophy is to go back to its roots. I mean, that was one of the things that it's kind of alienated us a little bit from the core, but it was something that was needed. We've gone back to thinking of what made EJ special, and it was things, well, two very simple things. One of them was the easy to use framework, the environment, and one of them was the great samples, the fact that they worked together perfectly. The overcomplicated features were great, but if you think of a pyramid, and at the bottom of the pyramid is the huge mass market of people that want to be able to use an easy-to-use product. And gradually, as you get to the top of the pyramid, you've got the people that want more and more features, more and more complicated features, which is great. It's great to service that that part because they are part of the core. But we've gone back a few levels and want to take people on a journey, but we want to go back to the beginning. So in terms of positioning, we're looking at the kind of Dance EJ3 as the starting position for where we wanted to take EJ Pure in terms of it was still, you know, it was only 16 or 32. I think it was 32 channels. Simple instruments, simple functionality. So we wanted to take it to that kind of feature set, modernized, obviously, and intuitive because it's a tablet and mobile, but obviously, and with up-to-date samples and a wider range of samples, because you know we don't want to just do a dance compilation or not even dubstep. Dubstep's great, but dubstep combined with rock and dance, I mean, that's a great combination. So we wanted to make it more modern in terms of music, wider in terms of demographic, but just keep it simple in terms of usability and functionality.
Now, one of the things I noticed about the prototype video on your Kickstarter page was the absence of the traditional scrolling song chart. Obviously, this method probably wouldn't work too well on touchscreens. And I was wondering if you could explain your alternative method of song navigation.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the prototype, the video prototype, or the prototype of the video is still a technology demo. I mean, we're examining different options in terms of minimizing layers, minimizing tracks. What's the best way to present the touch screens? I mean, it will change dramatically from the video that you've seen. I mean, in terms of not just the look, but also the functionality. I mean, really, it was I won't even call it a pre-alpha. It was a very, very early demonstration because we had to show something, but the key thing is to get it working and get it tested and lots of iterations of it. I don't think we're going to nail it first time round. But one thing we are moving away from is initially we're going to scale it back to simplicity. We need to make it work. And once it's working and it's functional, then we can add pretty graphics, pretty animations, and the like.
Now, obviously, we touched on touchscreen presents a number of opportunities as well as probably some drawbacks from either a mouse and keyboard setup or a game controller interface. And can you talk about any of the ideas that maybe you've engineered for Pure? You mentioned you're shooting for a tablet.
We're shooting for tablet. I mean, to be fair, we're actually shooting for mobile as well, as in mobile phones, and still have the same experience. That's why we think we need to be able to minimize screen and tracks and be able to utilize the space effectively, and being able to see what's going on other tracks whilst working on other tracks is really important. But obviously real estate is limited, so and people's fingers, you know, are different sizes. I have stumps, so I'm a good guinea pig, because if it works with my fingers, it will work with anybody's fingers. So I'm the test dummy on this one. But yeah, I mean, there are. I mean, we're spending a bit of time on the interface and the functionality, and obviously things are going to come in and out. The mixing functionality is a screen that will come in. The samples. One of the things that's really important is sample selection. Sample, you need to be able to listen, choose, edit samples really effectively. And almost as much time is being spent on that area as well as the track area, because those are the two key areas. Obviously, the tracks themselves where you put the samples, but also how you choose your samples, your favorites, you know, etc. So. But it can't all be done on one screen, so there's going to be some intuitive bringing in or opening up of screens and lots of swishing going on.
One thing I wanted to talk about was the output. What drove me crazy about EJ Club World was the lack of digital output. I had to connect my PS2 to these, you know, patch cables and record the music via analog methods. And I was wondering if Pure users will be able to have digital copies to share with others, or maybe even some kind of online functionality so that people can share their creations.
Absolutely. The base output will be at least an MP3. I think we'll be able to do other formats as well. We are trying to build a community hub so that it plugs in directly. I mean, that was one of the things that we were building in conjunction with the Kickstarter funds. Regardless, if it doesn't happen day one, we'll build it later on. But one of the things needs to be that you can plug into SoundCloud, YouTube, you know, all the different social media sites, or even your own website. So there will be a way of outputting, saving on your tablet or phone, and also uploading to and sharing. Because one of the key things of EJ Pure is about sharing your music and letting other people dance to your tracks, or you know. Yeah, so I mean, that side is important.
Okay. One direction for music creation suites is to provide a basic framework with a few samples and then charge for additional sound banks. Is that the route that EJ Pure will be taking?
Yes. We're giving away a free, the base product is free. If you can track back in the history of EJ, it's probably the equivalent of Dance EJ 1 or Dance EJ 2, i.e. that you've got enough tracks to have a really great experience. We're going to probably give away 3,000 samples, maybe more, in the base product. What we're hoping from that is that people will have such a great experience and, want a better word, get hooked and sort of hop onto the EJ ride and want to download more samples. The way we're going to monetize is one feature pack, there's only going to be one feature pack rather than lots of payments for micro features. So there'll be the base product, one feature pack payment, which will be constantly updating. And anyone that buys it will constantly get the updates for free. And then there'll be the samples. And the idea is to constantly make new samples, genre samples, world-based samples, and then eventually artist tie-ins.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the sample creation, your philosophies behind that? Obviously, you guys have talked about chiptunes, and you probably want to hit, you know, like the 90s house movement and really capture some of the key synthesizers, workstations, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The fundamentals, part of the fundamental success of EJ was the samples. Just come back from Germany, had a meeting with the music director, who was the original music director from EJ when it started and throughout until 2003. The philosophy of music is to, I mean, you hit the nail upon the head when you start this piece. I mean, it is a bunch of Lego bricks, for want of a better word, and they just all fit in together. Mm-hmm. But the reason they fit in together is because a lot of thought has gone into it to make it that mm-hmm. way. So whenever there's for example, a piece, whether it be a synth piece, it's done in different. So little layers are added to it, so that once it's chopped up into little bits, you can move it all around and it all sounds like it should fit together, but because of the arrangement will always be unique. Mm. So that philosophy, that a lot of thought and effort goes into the creation of the samples, so that it's not like you can buy any sample pack in the world, they will never sound like EJ samples, and they will never fit and work like EJ samples. What we are doing, we want to add variety and spice to music creation. The chiptune, yeah, brilliant, because, I mean, there is a big crossover between the people that played EJ and gaming. Mm-hmm. There was a massive crossover. I mean, they're probably almost sort of the two major pastimes of this audience. Mm-hmm. And to mix, chiptunes into dance tracks, whatever, that's great fun. Yeah. And also, to be honest, for video game developers, indie developers, mm-hmm. if you want to use EJ to prototype your track, prototype your indie game, your product, and the outputs are always royalty free. So there's a lot of positives for that. And plus, from a music point of view, I just want to open it up so that drum and bass can be mixed with some classical, can be mixed with some heavy drums. I don't know, just to try and provide lots and lots of musical flexibility.
Now, one last question. If readers are interested in contributing to EJ Pure's efforts, where can they go?
Yeah, go to kickstarter.com, type in EJ Pure. The page is there. There's lots of free samples. There's chiptune samples that you can download. There's lots of information and videos about EJ Pure and what we're about to do and what we're trying to do. And really just try and help us bring EJ Pure to the market.
Okay. Thank you so much, Leo.
All right. Thanks, Robert. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Trivia time.
Trivia.
That's all I get from you? Trivia.
Well, it's gonna be me and you. We've unfortunately we've lost Blue.
It was an elimination round.
Yeah, we sort of while that interview was going on, Blue and I had a trivia face off, and he won, but I had to kill him. So
Vitality.
Yeah, that was it.
Okay, number one this week, NetherRealm Studios is releasing Injustice: Gods Among Us onto the Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, and Wii U platforms. However, if you're in the Middle East, calling the game by that name might get you some quizzical looks. How should you ask for the game, Jeremy? A. Superheroes Gods Among Us. B. Injustice: The Mighty Among Us. C. Insurgency: Return to Justice. Or D. Final Justice: Gods Among Us.
I'm going to say they're probably going to go with something that is... Were there any of those... You're saying this is in the Middle East, right?
Yes.
Okay, I got to be careful here.
Tread carefully, Jeremy.
Instead of explaining my logic, I'm going to ask you to read me those choices one more time, and I'm just going to pick one.
Superheroes, Gods Among Us, Injustice, The Mighty Among Us, Insurgency, Return to Justice, or Final Justice. There's a lot of justice here. Gods Among Us.
I'm going to go with B.
Correct answer. B. Good job.
Yes.
Justice.
Okay.
The Mighty Among Us.
I swear my rationale was not racist in any way.
You're good. You're a good man. You're a gentleman. Number two. However you refer to Injustice, the game's roster of characters is fixed across the world. Name the combatant who won't be squaring off against Batman and Superman. A. Two-Face. B. Harley Quinn. C. Cyborg. Or D. Deathstroke. I already ruined this earlier.
Well, I know. I mean, I know at least one of them.
Right? Do you listen to me?
Yeah. I'm gonna say Cyborg is not in this one.
Correct answer. Two-Face.
Two-Face, really?
Yeah, Two-Face.
Oh. Well, he's kind of boring anyway. I mean, Cyborg at least has some cool moves he could do.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, everybody else in that list, actually, you know, in retrospect, Two-Face is probably the only right choice. Everybody else has, like, an awesome gimmick.
What if he had, like, two different fighting styles? Two very different. Maybe. I don't know, that could work.
World of the living and the world of the dead. And why is there not
How
more...
How much does Drinkbox paying you?
That's what you know what? I give my shilling freely to them. we need some more luchador-themed... There should be a Lucha Libre fighting game, quite honestly.
There was a wrestling game, and I think I was the only person in the world that liked that.
I see myself getting it.
Really? At E3, I was going nuts because there was an actual wrestling match in the on the show floor, and I was really getting into it because they were tossing people.
Was the game sort of like a tongue in cheek? Because you know,
they played it straight.
Well, so in an actual match, you can play it straight, but I feel like in a game, I don't know that you can really play Lucha Libre straight. I feel like you kind of have to. I mean, I was thinking about this. There are kind of a few Lucha Libre references in pop culture, right? Quite a few recently too. So there's Nacho Libre.
Okay.
Right, that was a comedy. There was. I'm gonna go really weird here.
Okay.
Yeah. You didn't like Nacho Libre?
Not as much.
I didn't really care for that much either.
Yeah,
no. There was also a Saturday morning cartoon called Mucha Lucha.
That's right. Yeah. Which
was all about luchadors. There was also in the Jackie Chan cartoon show, Jackie Chan Adventures, there was a character named El Fuerte, who was a luchador.
Okay.
And none of these characters, they never played it straight. Like, it's all kind of funny. You know. And I kind of dig that. There was a luchador area in Psychonauts, I believe. Yeah, there were some Lucha Libre fights.
Okay.
In the Black Velvetopia land in Psychonauts. Remember that? And there was
it's been a while.
There was like the eagle, and Raz would say, "Cuckoo," and he was just like smashed him or something, and he was like, "Cuckoo."
Jeremy, now I feel bad. I didn't give you Lucha Libre trivia.
You should have done. I don't actually know that much about Lucha, but actually, did you? You know, the other interesting thing that where Lucha Libre is popular is not just in Mexico, in Japan.
Lucha, oh, yeah.
I don't know if they call it Lucha.
This is where we really need Blue.
Yeah, I know. In fact, I was actually just going to really quick look this up. There was a news item just recently about and I'm sorry to interrupt your trivia with this, but there was a news item about Japanese luchador councilman refuses to remove mask. They have actually banned him. Did you hear about this?
No, but a luchador, you never let anyone see you remove your mask.
That's right. So here this is. There is in Japan, in the city of Oita, where a politician is. His name is Skull Reaper Aji.
I think that's my new name. Skull Reaper
Aji. Mm-hmm. The council members are prohibiting him from participating in city business unless he takes off his mask. But Skull Reaper refuses
Good
to give in to the band, explaining that without his mask, he is another man. He is someone else. He is not the people who elected Skull Reaper Aji.
Mm-hmm.
So
I want to see
anyway,
pile drive somebody that he disagrees with.
You know, I would like to see one of those cats. That's probably why they don't want him in there.
Right.
I mean, he's going to pick up a folding chair and like go to town on like the county tax assessor or something like that. And they don't need that. Anyway, so Mexican Lucha Libre, all the way in Japan. There you have.
Number three, thanks to Operation Rainfall's efforts, stateside Wii and Wii U owners will be allowed to enjoy the localized version of Pandora's Tower. For the U.S. release, the title was, of course, shortened. Which of the following is the closest translation of the original subtitle? A. Forever in Your Arms. B. Until I Return to Your Side. C. Together We Fight Onward. Or D. At Last, The Fates Decide.
Oh, man. You made all of those up except for one of them.
Yes, I did, Jeremy.
I mean, that's just, I mean, obviously you did that, but they all sounded really good. They all sounded completely obtuse. Yes. And for that, I congratulate you, Deagle.
Thank you. I believe I played enough of these.
Well done. Oh, God. Was there one about Together We Move Forward?
Did you say onward, that? Onward.
Together We Move
Onward. Not forward, onward.
No, okay, yes.
Big difference there.
Oh, my God. Who comes up with these? Who makes these? Look what they've done. They've broken.
It's an infinite undiscovery.
They've broken video games. Together we move onward in your arms. What was the other one?
Forever in your arms until I return to your side. At last, the fates decide.
Until I return to your side. Gosh, that seems kind of innocent enough, but still totally inane. I'm gonna go with that one. That one sounds good to me.
We have a winner. Until
really?
I return to your side. Yes. You sound surprised. It was a 25.
I have no idea. They all sounded so stupid.
Oh, Jeremy, you're calling my
trainers. I mean, in a good way, right?
In a loving way. Number four. Even before release here, Pandora's Tower met with a bit of controversy because of its cover jacket. Name the reason for the scandal. A. Protagonist was seen showing a bit of butt cleavage. B. Splashes of red around the top right corner of the cover resembled blood. C. The protagonist looked a bit too close to a character from Final Fantasy Versus 13. Or D, the game completely neglected any screenshot focusing on art inspired by the game.
What? The game focused... Say that last one again?
The cover completely neglected any screenshot focusing on art inspired by the game.
Okay, so we got butt cleavage, we got blood... And I'm sorry, what game was this?
This is Pandora's Tower, same as last
still,
one.
Still same game, okay.
Until I return to your side, Jeremy.
Because you know what I was... Until I returned to your side. Because you know what I was thinking about when you said butt cleavage?
Together we fight onward?
No. I was actually thinking of Catherine.
Okay.
Do you remember the... Was it the Xbox cover for Catherine that had kind of like a weird... like kind of butt cleavage thing, except it was in this completely anatomically... Like, at the bottom of the cover, she kind of was like resting on her folded arms, like kind of cute looking. And then like her lower back and her butt were like up at the top of the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so somehow she was like, you know, that's some real Escher Girls kind of stuff there. So
I know she had bra under a lingerie.
Yeah. So that was, and I think they did this different for the different versions. I think the PlayStation version was more for like boob men. And the Xbox cover was more for like ass men.
Hmm. Okay.
But that cover where with the ass cleavage was
good thing there wasn't a Wii U port.
I know, man. That would have been ugh. Okay, so I'm thinking not butt cleavage. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking not maybe splatters of blood. I could see that considering the way Nintendo is with that stuff. I still don't understand the thing about the cover art. No screenshots that focus on art from the game?
Yeah, you know, usually on a jacket on the back cover, there's some screenshots.
Oh, so just that there were no screenshots of any kind?
Yep.
Oh, okay. All right. Maybe. That one seems dumb enough. And then what was the last one?
Character looked too close to a Final Fantasy Versus 13.
They all kind of look the same. I don't think anybody would make that distinction. I'm going to go with the blood.
Correct answer.
Too
close to the character from Final Fantasy Versus 13.
That's got to be the first time ever that they've ever done anything like that. I mean, come on. There could be like a, you know, anime character generator somewhere. Just, you know, swap out the spiky hair and, you know, I mean, they all basically are made from the same template, aren't they?
Oh, Jeremy. Variations on a theme. Number five this week, developer Vanpool, named because they all commute together in a single white van. I'm kidding. Releasing Dylan's Rolling Western, The Last Ranger on the eShop. Name the one game that's not part of the studio's past efforts.
I hate these.
A,
yeah, go ahead.
I like that sound. A, minigames for Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga. B, assistance with Wii Play Motion. C, freshly picked Tingle's Rosy Rupee Land. Or D, DLC levels for new Super Mario Bros. 2.
Ooh, can I go get my copy of freshly picked Tingle's Rosy Rupee Land that I just imported?
You are bragging right now.
I am. That was a little bit of a humble brag, but it wasn't humble. It was just a braggy brag. I've been filling in my DS wish lists lately. Right. I got that, and I also got Final Fantasy XII Revenant Wings recently, which has kind of been on my list for quite a while.
Okay.
But I have it. And have you ever seen a European DS case? They're big and thick.
Are they?
It's like the difference between like a DVD case and a VHS case or something. I mean, it's like big and honking weird.
They were paper. VHS were paper? No, they were the big plastic. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm just like the big plastic ones. It feels similar to that. I mean, it doesn't look anything like that, but it was just a lot thicker than I expected it to be.
Like a book?
Kind of. I think there's actually a tome? Like a true codex.
Wow.
Of 30 something year old men in tights living in their parents' basement. I love the Tingle character, by the way. Well, where do you stand on Tingle?
Indifference.
Pro or no?
Kind of indifference.
I thrive on Tingle hate.
Really?
The more people hate Tingle, the stronger I become.
Okay. I'm just kind of. He's a curiosity.
It's my.
He doesn't really fit in with anything Nintendo's.
I know.
And that's why
it's so good. I don't know. I just like to troll people about it. But it's my one superpower, and if I'm going to gain strength from something, it might as well be from Tingle hate. Also, I'm very impressed.
I'd love to see Tingle in a Smash Brothers game, though.
Tingle has been in a Smash Brothers game, just not as a playable character.
Okay, but I'm sorry, as a playable character, Jeremy.
Picky. You know, I have to say, though, from these choices, the one that you said about doing mini games in Mario and Luigi?
Yes.
That is an interesting bit of information. If that turns out to be true, I wonder how. I'll answer one. I'm gonna say that one because I don't know how you would find out that this team specifically did that. So I'm gonna say that they were not involved in Mario and Luigi Superstar.
Correct answer: DLC levels for New Super Mario Bros. 2.
So let me ask you, because now I'm very pleased to know this, because I find that to be very interesting.
Vanpool.
How did you find that out?
Somebody did an interview with Vanpool.
An audio interview?
No, it was text based.
Because I was going to say, also...
I want to give credit to Nintendo Life, I guess, was the website that did the interview.
How about that? That is a really interesting... Because I don't remember them... I mean, I don't remember them in the credits or anything, but I'm assuming that would be like the battle minigames, like the different things they do.
I believe so.
I'm assuming, I don't know, but that is a great series, and that's a very interesting thing. Vanpool, subcontracting out for different things.
I love the name, Vanpool.
Vanpool, yeah, that's kind of weird. Well, good.
Let's open the mailbag. We have a question. Probably we've answered it before, but might have forgot to the answer from Super Mecha Jesus.
It bears repeating.
Maybe Jesus. I don't know. He says two-part super duper question.
That's his luchador name.
Yes.
I am Super Mecha Jesus.
Jeremy, any interest in the Oya?
Passing interest. I mean, I'm not interested in it right now until they make me interested in it, I guess.
What would make you interested in the...
Well, I guess let's think about this. So what are the strengths of the Ouya? I mean, what are they really banking on here? They're inexpensive.
Yeah.
Right? So yes. It's inexpensive. It's cheap, I guess, is another way of saying
plenty
that.
Of games already.
Yeah, it has an established...
But it does have its own marketplace, which is a little strange.
You know, one of the things I heard
hackability.
That's kind of part of it, too, right? But you could just kind of do that stuff on your PC, though.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I gotta say, probably not a lot of interest from me on the Ouya. At least not the first one. Now, the other thing they've said about that is that they're going to be doing like yearly iterations on the Ouya, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe give it a couple, three iterations, and maybe they'll start doing. I mean, they need to be able to play something that I'm interested in, which doesn't necessarily mean something that could only be on a console. And you know what? Maybe, you know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier. Maybe the Ouya becomes the crossover platform, you know?
Right.
Maybe people start developing stuff for the Android operating system, and that becomes their way of making a legitimate game that they can sell on a digital marketplace that's not unlike, you know, PlayStation Network or Xbox Live or the eShop. But then that allows them to get their software into, you know, the larger mobile phone and tablet space. Mm-hmm. So maybe in a little while, maybe you'll start to see stuff like that. I mean, all it's going to take is what? You know, your Infinity Blade-style games. I mean, just a few of those, you know, that are specifically Android-related. And I don't know. I mean, are they going out to try and cultivate those kinds of developers? I mean, are they trying to win those people over to – or are they just putting a box together and saying, okay –
I believe they are. I believe they try to cultivate a few unique developers.
I mean, you have to imagine that they're doing
that. I did see one game that looked interesting. It was pre-alpha. It was a big mech walking through a city.
I saw that too.
And oh, did you?
Well, the thing was, I kind of saw it in an ironic retweet on Twitter. I think it was Andrew Rayner over at Game Informer, you know, because the title of it was in some forum somewhere, like some Ouya, you know, enthusiast forum. And it was like, If you don't believe that Ouya can do great games, look at this. And it was like a 30-second thing of this mech kind of walking through, and it like
empty city
throws it or something. Yeah, like, okay, well, all right, you know, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, but I wouldn't be going around like, you know, oh, great games on the Ouya.
It looks really early.
I think they even said like, oh, this is something we did in a week.
Okay,
you know, all right, well, come talk to me again in another, you know, 8 to 12 months. So kind of,
you know what, I'm a little bit more curious in the game stick for some reason. Again, affordability, I think that one will be a little bit cheaper, higher specs, and I think one of the things about the Ouya was the actual specs were pretty middling right now, and much like you said, second, third iteration, hopefully they'll kind of bump that up and maybe have different levels, platforms, things like that. So you know, I'd like to really see what maybe a quad core, Android game could really punch out.
The thing is, though, I wonder if that's not a problem for them, is like fragmenting, you know, the operating system and having to develop on different platforms. Because the thing about the Android as a platform is that it's one operating system, and you either run it or you don't. And that's kind of a problem for Android in general, right? I mean, I saw I saw something just recently about the Unity game engine, where they were talking about, you know, everybody who uses iOS devices, 90-some-odd% of those people are on the latest version of the iOS, whereas, you know, 60% of Android people are still two versions, you know, from like last year or something like that.
Yeah, I did have a problem when I had the iPhone 3, and then there was kind of the upgrade. I think the 4 and the 4S had just come out, and a lot of things were no longer available, and so that did kind of fragment the.
Yeah, that's true too. With iOS, it's like you either have it
the hardware,
if you don't, you need to buy a new one.
Yep.
So I don't know. I mean, right now I'm still, for me with Ouya, I'm still in, you know, let's wait and see, but I'm at least listening to what they have to say mode.
Yeah,
which is, that's the long name for the mode I'm in, but you know, we'll see.
Okay. Second part of the question: there's been a lot of people saying that Kickstarter has jumped the shark. Do you think so?
I don't know. People have been saying that since Kickstarter first came out, right?
Right.
I don't know.
I do. Well, not so much jump the shark, but I do think we have seen a change. Originally, I thought Kickstarter was for indies, and then, you know, we saw Ouya, we saw Double Fine, Penny Arcade, some well-established...
Double Fine is not indie?
No, they're not. They're well-established, and they're a fairly sizable studio, that have already put out products for, you know, major publishers.
I'm not going to nail you down on this point, but I think...
That well, how do we define somebody... indie? How do we define
right. it? Well, and guess what?
Okay, how about an upstart? Are they an upstart? No.
Okay, all right.
Okay. So
that's
here's
not the same as indie, though.
No, that's not. But something that we could agree upon. But here's the thing about Kickstarter. I think now we are seeing these entities that are well-established, that are not upstarts, and they're getting a lot of attention. And, you know, maybe deservedly so. They're putting out some really kind of cool products. And the Kickstarter pages themselves are very glossy. You know, they'll have videos, and they'll have a lot of really intricate stuff that robust design teams are able to create. And when you pit that against maybe a 2 or 3 man team, it just doesn't compare as well. And so I think one of the problems is that Kickstarter is being used by these entities that already kind of well established, and we're moving away from perhaps maybe the true independent spirit that drove Kickstarter, or you know, that momentum that did have that spark. And my worry is that it's going to be used for you know, for corporate reasons, just to raise financing, and maybe that will steal some of the thunder of some of these smaller indies. Agree, disagree?
I don't know that I have a problem with that.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, they may be making, you know,
Well, here's the thing, then. What outlet does a budding, an emerging indie developer have to make their product known to the world? If Kickstarter is going to be this kind of corporatized, you know, big budget thing,
why can they not use Kickstarter, or, you know, even like Indiegogo or something like that? Or, I mean, there are lots of crowdfunding sources out there, but why can't you have, you know, Obsidian or Black Isle or whoever? Why can't you have them doing their thing and asking for $6 million or whatever, and have some 2 or 3 man team that just wants, you know, 50 to 60,000 or less, mm-hmm, to do their I mean, I don't see any reason why those can't coexist.
I just think the bulk of the money goes towards, and I wish I had some stats to back that up, bulk of the money kind of goes towards these big projects, and maybe, you know, the amount of attention that they get is disproportionate.
I don't think that has anything to do with the size of the project, though. I think that has more to do with what people want. I mean, the fact is that you know, companies like Double Fine, mm-hmm, do things that people want to pay them for. I mean, and people know, hey, this is a company that makes things that I like. Let me give them money to get more things that I like. I think the trouble for an upstart, as you put it, is they kind of have to, you know, they not only have to come up with a pitch, mm-hmm, that is going to convince people to pay them, but they're also going to have to try and shout all the louder to, you know, get publicity. Not because there are other teams or other people doing Kickstarters, mm-hmm, but because nobody knows them, and they just have to get that publicity to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that's why people like Sai, I mean, she does a lot of promotion and you know, Facebook and Twitter and things like that. And that's just something that she does. But, you know, in one way or another, those people have to promote themselves to get people to that page to decide that they want to give them money. I mean, they have more hurdles to overcome, but I don't think that's because other projects are also concurrently requesting dollars.
Okay.
I mean, maybe on some level, because I mean, you know, again, people only have a finite amount of money to spend.
I do have one statistic. 2012, there was $56 million pledged in Kickstarter video games. $30 million of that, by far the bulk, was divvied up between 12 projects.
Mm-hmm.
$8.5 million to Ouya. So obviously kind of the big ones are pulling down a lot of the Kickstarter money.
Ouya's an upstart, though, right?
Right, right.
So, I mean, I think it just depends on what it is that people are peddling, or mm-hmm, what it is they're promising, and what it is they say they want to do.
Wasn't it an upstart from well-established people within the industry?
Yeah, but I don't think people... I mean, on some level, people look at the names, but I mean, for something like a new game platform,
mm-hmm,
I don't, you know, I think people are going more on, I mean, you know, the other thing was the Oculus Rift, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was another thing, and I mean, I don't know anybody that did anything with that, but that, you know, was just something that people said, hey, that's a neat idea, I want to do that. And I think that, you know, being that there are so many games in general that are out there, I mean, a lot of Kickstarters trade on nostalgia or trade, mm-hmm, on, you know, just things that people are already interested in, you know, and I think it's a lot easier for people to get involved. I think that it may be a little more difficult. So back to the original question, whether Kickstarter has, you know, seen the best of its days. I think that we may be at a point now where, I mean, there have been projects in the past where people would rally around a particular, you know, project that may have been, mm-hmm, troubled or may have, there. And there were a lot of those, you know, like last year, for example, there was Camouflage, Ryan, mm-hmm, Payton and his,
yes,
crew. Mm-hmm. That was one that was basically on the path to failure until, right, you know, everybody kind of like, oh, everybody, you know, we love these guys. Let's do it.
Right.
Or the guy who did, what was the one who was doing the new tactical shooter? Christian, what was his name? Anyway, they wanted a SOCOM style game. Mm-hmm. Again, same sort of thing. I don't think that we're going to be at a point as much anymore where people are going to rally around causes that are troubled. I think we're probably going to continue to see things where, you know, hey, that's Lord British. I like his games. Well, you know, mm-hmm. boatloads of money.
Right. Or kind of, you know, the guilt. The guilt, or this is disappearing kind of thing.
Yeah. All or right. Again, nostalgia related right. things where, mm-hmm. you know, hey, we've been wanting this for a long time and there's a lot of pent up demand for something. But I think that we're probably going to see maybe more. And the other thing of it, too, is what are people asking for? You know, I mean, Double Fine asked for, well, I mean, what was it? You know, we should all know this by now, but what was their original ask? They wanted like 300,000 or 400,000
400,000, right.
And they, you know, and they got way more than that. And I think the for some of those projects, they've been asking for more and more mm-hmm. and more. Mm-hmm. And there are some that, you know, ask for not as much and still.
I think it made what, 3 million. 3,200,000
Yeah, over 3 million, I think, at the time.
3 million.
And so that's going to be part of it as well. But by, you know, on the other hand too, you have to be able to deliver. I mean, if you, you know, even if you're looking for alternate funding solutions in conjunction with Kickstarter, if people meet your funding goal for something, you better be able to, you know,
right.
to do it, you know. The other thing too that I guess in relation to this question is, I mean, we about a year ago, I mean, there were Kickstarters left and right cropping up, sure. right? Have projects been released left and right since then? I mean, have we? It seems like we've seen a handful of things maybe that have mm-hmm. have actually come to pass.
Well I think the statistic of Kickstarters is about as far as the viability. I think about 56% are not successful. So the majority of them, 56 to about 60% are
not. In terms of funding or in terms of completion?
In terms of funding.
Funding, yeah. So that's the other thing. I mean, I think people then, right now have...
And then the other thing about completion is, of course, most of the games aiming towards PC or console, we're looking at 2 years.
Yeah, quite a while. And that's the, I mean, to me, that's the other thing too, is that at this juncture, I mean, I think we've had wave after wave of Kickstarters that everybody's been interested in. And people who are going to donate to that stuff, I think they've got quite a bit of money tied up in various Kickstarter projects. And I think we're probably going to need to start seeing some more things actually,
yeah,
like I said, come to pass before we're going to be, you know, continually pouring money into this thing that up to this point is...
I think Giano Sisters, that was one I reviewed both on PC and 360, and that turned out to reason, you know, very well.
Yeah.
As a pure platformer.
Well, and FTL was another one that came out. It seems like there have been a few games, too. Mm-hmm. There's at least one more that I'm thinking of that was Kickstarter funded. Anyway, so there are a few, but, you know, for all the headlines and the news that you know, Kickstarter projects got, say, a year ago, I guess if we start eventually seeing things released with that same kind of frequency, you know, maybe we'll again see more of a, you know, more of a resurgence of, you know, people being more willing to again put money back into it. But I kind of get the feeling right at the moment anyway that we're sort of in a digestion cycle where we're sort of waiting for some of this stuff to come back out. So if Kickstarter is losing its luster, I think it may be, you know,
so are you going to waste the waste just to leave the body
first? What was it in Lamort Arthur? It's Madam, what's her name? She says that appetite waits on good on digestion, something like that. Okay. Anyway, so maybe for the time being, we're sort of in a little bit of a lull. I don't think that means Kickstarter's going anywhere anytime soon. I think it's been way too lucrative for projects that have been successfully funded. But I think we need to start seeing some more stuff actually happening again before maybe it, you know, it's back the way it did before.
Okay.
Good question.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Super Mecha Jesus.
Yes. And thank you guys for listening to our show. Let's take it on home. If you want to read some of our reviews, follow us on www.techgaming.com. We are also on Google Current, so you can read us without the ads, so we don't get paid. If you want to follow me, I am tech_gaming. Jeremy is Jeremy_Lamont.
Lamont.
Lamont. Not with us because he got eliminated is Blue Swim. He is at Blue Swim. Sage is at Samurage. And Psy is at Psy OMG WTF.
It is true.
Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everybody.
In AD 2101, war was beginning.
I need a status report.
Self-destruct sequence has been initiated.
We've got an incoming transmission.
What?
Patching it through.
Deactivation of command function override requires altitude clearance.
It's you. How are you, gentlemen? We have successfully acquired your base of operations. Prepare to be destroyed.
One enemy boss is trapped.
How dare you? Your time has run out. Savor your final moments.
This is someone's idea of a practical joke, right?
Captain, what should we do?
Arm every SIG for deployment. Initiate launch sequence. Open the pod bay doors. Justice shall be served.
Give me a reading.
All right. This is a dramatic reading for Pretty Guardian Sailor Moon Volume 2 by Naoko Takeuchi. This time I will be revived, and I must have that stone to ensure the world falls within my grasp. Yes, this time the world... everything in this universe will. As I watch, she grows darker and more expansive.
And this is 50 Shades of Grey, read by Blue.
50 Shades of...
Sailor Moon.